Welcome to Parents' Perspective. Deborah's dad leaned across the dinner table and smiled at his six-year-old daughter.
So how was school today?
He inquired. Deborah wrinkled her nose and looked down at her plate.
Not so good,
she mumbled. Are you having trouble with the work? Her mom asked gently.
No,
Deborah shook her head.
Are any of the kids giving you trouble?
Prodded her dad.
No,
Deborah fiddled with her fork. Well, sweetie, you can tell us, encouraged her mom. What is the matter? Deborah took a deep breath and then looked from one parent to the other.
It's really a waste of time, she began.
A waste of time in the first grade?
Her dad responded.
Yes, Deborah replied. I can't read. I can't write. And they won't let me talk.
From a parent's perspective, what should we know about the kinds of tasks our schools are charged with? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest has written on the subject of how much involvement and responsibility should be expected of our schools when it comes to raising our children. Noel Epstein has spent more than 40 years as a journalist with The Washington Post and The Wall Street Journal. He has written and edited two books and is currently an independent consultant. In 1969, he was also a writer and editor for the White House Conference on Children and Youth. Noel has two grown daughters and four grandchildren, with another on the way. Welcome to Parents' Perspective, Noel.
Thank you very much.
What are some of the concerns American parents have about our public schools?
Oh, American parents are concerned about everything virtually about our public schools. The question is basically which one of their priorities, really. While elites in business and politics and education and the media focus principally on student achievement, test scores, parents are much more concerned about the safety and well-being of their children at schools. The polls have shown for a number of years that they are more concerned about violence in schools, gangs in schools, drugs in schools, than they are about how their schools did on the latest test in math or science.
Is this more since Columbine and those kinds of things, or has this been across the board?
It's broader since Columbine. One of the things that's very interesting that's happened is that the schools years ago used to be concerned about disease, violence, not drugs so much 100 years ago, but many other social and health issues. But for the disadvantaged student, mainly 100 years ago, at the turn of the 20th century, about immigrant children who were teeming and pouring into the cities, today these concerns have broadened. Now you have disease concerns about middle class and affluent children. Obviously, a lot of suburbs worry about crack cocaine as much as the inner cities. In fact, they can afford it much more in the suburbs than they can in the inner cities. You worry about drunk driving among suburban kids. You don't hear a lot about it among inner city minority students, drunk driving. It's mainly a concern. Violence, Columbine, and the other crises of school shootings in the schools and other school violence. School violence is by no means limited to shootings. There are lots of other school-related deaths occurring every year in the United States.
Is this something that is a 20th century thing, or was this something, I mean, you picture schools in the very olden days as being so strict that if you said anything, you'd get your hand slapped with a ruler. I can't imagine that violence would have been an issue.
Well, this is kid-on-kid violence rather than kid-on-teacher violence, but I don't think these days that you have great discipline in the schools. I mean, that's one of the problems. And we have legally, students now know they have rights, and parents know they have rights, and there are a lot of suits going on, and corporal punishment is not exactly favored in almost any school system, though there are some, I believe, that's still permitted.
My husband still describes being hit over the knuckles with a ruler when he was a little boy, and he said they just accepted that. They knew that if they misbehaved in the classroom, he was growing up in the city of Boston, that was acceptable for the teacher to rap them on the knuckles.
Well, that's when parents deferred to teachers a lot. in modern times, certainly perhaps since the 50s to today, maybe the 60s to today, there's been growing challenge mm-hmm. of teacher authority by parents. A lot of parents, more and more parents are well educated, and more parents think they know as much or more than the teacher about child rearing as well as about academics. So there's not as much deference given to what the teacher does. I don't think parents today would just accept, if your child came home from school today or your grandchild and said that the teacher rapped me on the knuckles, I think you'd be in the principal's office pretty quickly.
About 1 second.
So I don't think that that's what goes on.
And on the other hand, I have friends who have retired from teaching because they're not allowed even to hug a student or to congratulate a student. I'm so happy for you, and put an arm around them, or drive them home if they missed the school bus and they're late. Teachers can't do that either.
That's true. That takes you back to legal challenges.
Yeah.
Just as doctors are afraid to treat somebody they run across who's very ill on the street for fear of malpractice suits. Legal challenges are a serious problem. Don't misunderstand me. There are plenty of cases where doctors did indeed behave badly and cause problems, and there are plenty of places where there have been, unfortunately, teachers who have taken advantage of students, sexually and otherwise. So people worry about that more and have provided legal protections for it.
What kind of functions do you think we want now from our schools?
Well, I don't think that the public actually realizes what they want from their schools. I think this is a very important point. I think that we have gradually and sometimes almost imperceptibly heaped more and more responsibilities on the schools, non-academic responsibilities. I mean, schools are now responsible, obviously, for feeding children. They not only feed them school lunches, and incidentally, a majority of the students who take school lunches are not eligible for free lunches. They get slightly subsidized, federally subsidized school lunches. I think the federal government pays 20 cents for every school lunch that middle class and affluent children also eat at school. But we have now have school breakfasts, school snacks after school. For after-school programs, during after-school programs, you have school snacks provided federally. And in some cases, there are school dinners because there are, several thousand schools that stay open until 10 o'clock at night. And so the children get dinners and kids don't get picked up until after that.
So, are these schools that serve children from underprivileged families? Or
the majority of those schools are.
Okay.
But the after-school programs are becoming almost universal. They're everywhere, and they're schools serving middle-class kids because of latchkey children, children who come home to empty houses. And you have millions of latchkey children, and so you have after-school programs with snacks provided for students across economic classes and races.
So that's a case where we're expecting the school to provide for the child so the child doesn't go home to an empty house.
Right. Oh, indeed. After-school programs are enormously popular, and they cross partisan lines as well. One of the biggest advocates for after-school programs in the United States, and most important, has been Arnold Schwarzenegger in California. He kind of saved $400 million for the federal after-school program. When President Bush wanted to cut it a couple of years ago, he came in and came to the rescue on his white horse and saved it. So after-school programs are very, very popular. They make lots of claims for them, which are not necessarily supported, but they're popular nonetheless. Before-school programs are increasingly popular, where kids come in 7 o'clock, 7:30, and affluent parents drop them off for breakfast, as well as poor parents. There's a problem with the school breakfast program, and that is that anti-hunger advocates were worried that not enough poor students who are eligible were actually participating in school breakfast programs. And so, though most of the nation, almost all the nation, had no idea this was going on, we had a 3-year pilot program to provide free school breakfasts for everybody whether you were poor or affluent, free. In order, the belief was among the anti-hunger advocates that if you got the more affluent children in, it would take away a stigma of poverty from these school breakfast programs and get more parents and children from poor families to participate. That hasn't exactly been borne out in the studies, but they're trying to get more students to participate in school breakfast programs. In any case, you have feeding programs are just one thing that schools are involved in, and before school program, kind of the babysitting function, which they're trying to turn into an academic function, teach the kids while they're there after school as well as do other things.
And the fast food machines that are installed in a lot of the schools are now, I understand, being changed over to dispensing juices instead of the sugared drinks.
In some cases.
Yes,
I
not
everywhere.
I don't
think that's widespread yet, but I think there have been a start on that.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion about schools doing double duty.
Washington, D.C. with Kids, an excellent book by authors Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We are talking with Noel Epstein about schools and their responsibilities to our children.
Now you also have the desire among parents and the business world to have children start school earlier at 3 or 4 years old. In fact, the business community, at least as reflected by the Council for Economic Development, the CED, which is a very prestigious and valuable organization, has argued in a work they did on preschool for all that we ought to start kids at 3 or 4 years old. So the idea is now that the cumulative effect of all this is, if it comes to pass, there are pre-K kindergarten programs in public schools. And incidentally, the polling that I've seen, the last poll I guess I saw was a Gallup poll in 2000, more than 80% of Americans wanted pre-K, pre-kindergarten classes to be part of public schools, not to be provided by private daycare, but part of public schools.
And what's the justification? Why are the parents?
Somebody, I'm paying for the public schools. I need my children to be taken care of. Why pay for, there is no questions about justification. The business community's justification obviously has to do with parents who are working, young parents who are working, and they need labor, obviously. And they argue, again, that pre-K contributes. This is not important to the learning of the child if you get them in school early and prepare them early, and it contributes ultimately to the economic productivity of the nation if you teach them academics early as well as other things. Now, there are great debates that go back 100, 150 years about whether teaching academics to very young children is helpful and in some cases whether it's harmful. There's a very interesting story you might want to know about. There was in the 1820s or 30s, there was a famous physician called Amariah Brigham. He was the head of two mental institutions during his lifetime and one of the early advocates of psychology and psychiatry, and in fact was a founder of the American Psychiatric Association and the first editor and publisher of the American Psychiatric Journal back then. He did a work, I think it was around 1830, I don't have that handy, it's in my book, on the deleterious effects of trying to teach academics to very young children. He said it actually would drive them crazy. I'm not joking.
That's scary, isn't it?
He said it would result in mental derangement. And his work was so influential at the time that it killed what then were called infant schools. They had schools for children who were 1.5 to 2 years old and a little bit older. It killed that movement and had a great influence on the kindergarten movement, so that kindergartens would not, when they started and to today, would not teach academics. They teach social skills and play skills and things like that. So this work had an enormous effect. In any case, you have the schools, when you add one thing on top of another, schools responsible for drug programs, fighting drugs. Schools are responsible for fighting youth alcoholism. Schools are responsible for fighting smoking. Schools are responsible for fighting obesity. Schools are responsible for preventing student suicides, depression, violence we discussed, for feeding students, for taking care of them after school and before school. Schools have taken over many, many parental functions one by one. It hasn't been some deliberate movement. It's been a cumulative, gradual adding on to school responsibilities. And I don't think Americans realize how much they've put on the backs of schools. So you ask me what Americans want from schools. They want more, 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 and more that are non-academic, in addition to the business community, the political community, the media, the elite, and others, and upper-class parents and middle-class parents wanting better and better academics. So the schools, I've said in my studies, are kind of the American version of the Israeli kibbutz, which was the communal child-rearing institution, although not the original kibbutz, today's kibbutz. Originally, the kibbutzim in Israel, so far as child-rearing was concerned, a child would be born and put into a separate house, children's houses, where they were raised separately from the parents who went out to work in mainly agricultural chores, and still are in many cases in Israel today. The small, there are only 4% of Israel live on kibbutzim today, 4 or 5, I believe. But in any case, I think the school is becoming that, but by accident, you know, not by deliberate means. And I think we have to face that.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion about schools doing double duty.
For an audio CD of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $10 with your name, address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C. 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Noel Epstein about schools and their responsibilities to our children.
It seems like the federal government and the states is constantly a tug of war, because if the parents want more from the schools, the funding's got to come from somewhere. And everybody's going, well, I don't have it.
It's interesting. The funding comes from multiple places for these programs. Some funding obviously comes out of the U.S. Department of Education, state departments of education, and local property taxes. Other funding comes from the Agriculture Department, which pays for school lunches and breakfasts and snacks, etc. Other funding comes from the Department of Justice, which worries about school violence. Other funding comes from the Centers for Disease Control, the Public Health Service, which provides funding for... This is very important today. We talked earlier about how concerns have broadened from the poor to the middle class and affluent in through schools. HIV/AIDS is certainly by no means limited to poor kids. And there are something like 4,000 high school students today, or teenagers today at least, who have AIDS, and thousands more with the HIV virus that becomes AIDS, commonly over 10 years. You have an epidemic of sexually transmitted diseases, STDs, according to this, again, Centers for Disease Control. And that's by no means limited to poor kids. So all these things are society-wide with a large constituency. and people wanting somebody to take care of it. The reason we use the schools is because that's where the kids are at least 9 months, 8-9 months out of the year, and many kids during the summer. So that's why the schools get the responsibility.
What do you think that we as parents and as families should be doing to facilitate more productive public schooling, or what would make it more productive?
Well, that depends upon how you define productive.
Right.
If you're talking about productive in academic terms, they're doing a lot. They're trying a lot. That's what No Child Left Behind is about. That's what state exit exams in high school are about that are growing. That's what all kinds of programs, federal, state, and local, are aimed at. Many of these programs that are non-academic, incidentally, are justified on academic terms. You can't have hungry children doing well in academics. You can't have depressed or suicidal children doing well in academics. You can't have children on drugs, children using alcohol and so forth, and all the other problems doing well academically. That's part of school law to make this case among the anti-hunger and other advocates. The question to me is, how do you do the things that are non-academic, all these non-academic efforts, well? And how do you decide which ones really are worth doing, and how do you decide which ones don't work in terms of meeting their goals, whatever those goals are, however you define them, and get rid of them, but add others that for which there are no programs right now. I'll give you one example here. There's a great concern among what are called vision therapists that many students really are incapable of reading sufficiently what they are seeing, what's on the blackboard, or reading their books, not because of standard eye chart stuff, but because of double tracking in their vision, inability to follow text. In any case, this is a serious problem. There's a wonderful story, an African-American gentleman who, as a kid, moved around a lot, and he was in the Detroit public schools around fourth or fifth grade and got zeros on all his exams, zeros, until a teacher realized that he needed glasses. Couldn't see the board. This gentleman became the chief of pediatric surgery at Johns Hopkins, and he wrote a wonderful book about it. I think he retired recently from that job. Vision, like hearing, is a serious problem that we touch on in the most cursory way in the schools. So there actually may be programs that we do need that we're not doing. In terms of vision, not just looking at whether children can read eye charts, because that may not tell you a lot.
But the example you gave is about the school discovering the child needed glasses.
That's correct.
This is another example where the parents didn't notice. The parents probably...
Well, in his case, it was a grandmother, I believe, who was raising them. And one, they were poor, and I don't know that they had money for glasses anyway. The school got them the glasses.
I remember talking with James Earl Jones, who said it was a teacher who helped him get past his stuttering. A teacher said, "You'll be able to overcome this." It didn't happen any other way without that teacher's help.
That's true. Well, teachers have long played that role.
Well, we unfortunately have to close, and this is a conversation that could go on for a very long time. There's an awful lot to talk about. But what resources would you suggest for our listeners who would like to pursue this topic further?
Well, there are lots of different resources for different listeners. I mentioned the Center for Health and Healthcare in the Schools that Julia Graham Lear runs. It's www.healthandschools.org. You get a lot of information on health and social issues in the schools there. It's a really fascinating website. I recommend it. Then there's the Coalition for Community Schools that's headed by a gentleman named Marty Blank, which is communityschools.org. That's one word, www.communityschools.org. There's always, as I'm sure everybody knows out there, the Children's Defense Fund, which touches on a lot of these issues.
Which started No Child Left Behind.
There's the National Child Care Information Center, if you're interested in lots of child care issues. It's www.nccic, for Child Care, National Child Care Information Center, .org, NCCIC. There's a site called Just for Kids, which has a lot of kids' issues on it, called Just and the Number 4 Kids.org. For what's happening in different states, you can go to ECS.org. That's the Education Commission of the states. They have a wealth of information on their websites on policies out there in the states. For books, there's a lady named Joy Dryfoos, D-R-Y-F-O-O-S, who has written a lot of works on community schools and advocated them. It's useful to get a hold of her works. One is called Inside Full Service Community Schools, if you're interested in seeing how some schools have been reformed to deal with all these non-academic health and social issues that we heap on the schools. There's a wonderful book called The Price of Motherhood, which might be of interest to your listeners in general, by Anne Crittenden, The Price of Motherhood. The subtitle, and which I'm sure many of your listeners will agree with, is Why the Most Important Job in the World is Still the Least Valued. So there are those resources. There are others. If you want to read about school governance and the confusion out there, the book that I edited for the Education Commission of the States and published by the Brookings Institution Press is called Who's in Charge Here? The Tangled Web of School Governance and Policy. And has my name on it, Noel Epstein, as the editor.
Well, Noel Epstein, this has been such a pleasure talking with you, and thank you so much for demystifying some of the issues about our public schools.
Thank you for inviting me.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of our book, Washington, D.C. with Kids. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address, and mention show number 285. That's 1-800-791-8573. And please spell anything that's not obvious. That's a very big help to us. Also, if you can, tell us what station you're listening to. Since we air all over the world, it's always fun to know where you are tuning in. Our book, Washington, D.C. with Kids, is available in all major bookstores and on the web.
To learn more about Parents' Perspective, visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org. That's www.parentsperspective.org. At the site, you can click on to listen to podcasts to hear a show anytime. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. Today's program was made possible with generous support from the Bonneville Foundation. Our sound engineer is Damon Fisher. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.